We will come to order, and I'm going to jump around a little bit, and I see one of the authors in the audience here. Mr. Thiessen has a bill up that, I don't know, I'm entirely sure. Supposed to be number two, but I was thinking if you would like to go number one and move on with your life.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. That'd be great.
Okay, we have a quorum, so I think I'm going to move your bill. I'd like to move House File 42 be recommended to pass and return to the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Representative Thiessen, could you kind of give us a broad overview? You've got an amendment. We can put that on first if you'd like, and then I think that which is in this committee's preview is on page 4, line 8 to line 16. So hopefully...
That's what we can focus on, Mr. Chair. And if we could put the amendment on just to get the bill in the shape that... And it really has nothing to do with this committee, to be quite honest, but just so as it travels, that people know what we're looking at.
We're just kind of like a building block for you. Chair will move the A5 amendment to get the bill in the
just briefly, what the amendment does for people who are interested, as this bill relates to providing health care to people that lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government in the stimulus package passed a 65% subsidy for people that want to extend their COBRA coverage. And what this would do as one piece of the bill would do a state supplement. Most of the information we've gotten is that most people, especially on unemployment, at what those income levels would be, couldn't afford a COBRA subsidy unless it gets in the range of 85%. And so this would kind of add, through Health Care Access Fund dollars, an additional bump on the
this
subsidy.
Would be kind of stuff that you deal with in your committee, yes. Or Representative Huntley's committee. So
that's right.
Why don't we skip? You got your amendment on. Let's go to page.
We got it.
All those in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
You got your amendment.
All right. So the large overview is what I just said, which is basically this is trying two different ways to provide assistance to people that lose their jobs to get health care. One is through this additional bump on the COBRA assistance, and the other is through the health. It's through a eligibility for Minnesota Care without a four-month waiting period. This committee, the main point is that we're asking the Department of Employment and Economic Development to include information about these programs and an application in the information they send out to people who have applied for unemployment benefits. They'll send that back into DHS. So once DEED sends out that application, their relationship to this is done.
DEED has to send a letter, according to your bill.
Yes.
Any questions? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there, Representative Thiessen, is there a, I'm wondering about a gap between when people have applied for unemployment and when they actually would get a response from DEED, and whether if their health insurance terminates in that time, if there's any issue that may arise, or if there is some other additional notice that we can provide people that may, so they don't actually have to wait until they get a letter back from unemployment, or if that's maybe not an issue.
So, Mr. Chair, that I think that is an issue. We're going to advertise the program in other ways as well, but this seems to be the most direct way to at least get. I think DEED is going to put it on their website as well, it sounds like, perhaps, and things like that. So it is an issue, but I can't figure out a better way to accomplish it practically.
Any follow-up?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the only other idea is that we do have, there are laws about providing notice to employees about layoffs, and so we could include perhaps a notice requirement as part of those layoff notices that people may be able to get access to that.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Winkler, and in fact, I think the COBRA, the federal stimulus package includes some provisions like that, so we may be able to piggyback on that. Thank you. That's a good idea. It's good I came to this committee.
It's always good to come and visit with us. Members, any other questions? Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this isn't a finance committee, but I just was curious on a couple things. Do you have kind of a baseline idea of what this is going to cost?
and Mr. Chair, we're still getting a fiscal note on it. It's actually a very narrowly, it's a fairly narrowly structured bill now for who can apply for the Minnesota Care piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we still haven't got, well, you'll see it when it comes back to health finance. We'll get the fiscal note by then. And the other piece I would say, just for members' information, the Healthcare Access Fund now in 2013 is running a $94 million surplus. So we have a structural balance there. And significantly about this, this program will sunset in 2011. So it's a very narrowly tailored in terms of time as well to this economic crisis. So it's a use of one-time money in a sense. And I would also note that, well, it's beyond the purview of the committee, so we won't go there.
I don't want to go too far afield from the purview of our committee. Yeah. Representative Anderson, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, you have in your amendment effective retroactive to February 17th, 2009, and yet throughout the bill it goes effective July 1, 2009. And I'm just wondering, maybe I'm not reading the amendment or reading the bill correctly. Can you explain the effective date?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that provision has to do with kind of our piggybacking on the federal stimulus package, which I believe passed on February 17th, 2009, and people have up to 60 days to apply for COBRA, or 63 days to apply for COBRA. So if this were to pass very quickly, there may be a time left there where they could kind of, if it conforms to the federal subsidy for the COBRA. I don't know if it'll have, honestly, any practical impact based on the timeline of this bill, but That's the thought there.
Representative Pepin, did you have something to page 4, line 8 to 16?
Page 4, line 16. I just have kind of a general question, Mr. Chair. Representative Thiessen, I guess my concern with the bill is it seems to kind of set a precedent for a new group of people and provide richer coverage for a certain group of people, and I'm just wondering if you could maybe comment about that. For example, it's extending benefits to underemployed people, but there are a lot of, you know, business owners perhaps that are struggling financially, and it seems like it's just sort of, kind of carving out very rich benefits and a kind of setting a new precedent for a group of people, and I'm wondering if kind of set this up in the long run, and I just wonder if you could comment on that.
I will.
I think that would be really much more geared towards your healthcare policy.
Yeah.
I mean, we really have some ideas, some comments on the letter that you want to send. So I'm going to try and focus this down because we've got four bills to get through.
Maybe I'll just say we did have that discussion in healthcare policy as it moved through it, and we'll probably have it again in finance. So and I can talk to you more about that. We're in a unique circumstance right now where people who usually haven't been in need of health care assistance but are losing their jobs in massive numbers, up to 16% in some counties in this state, need this help right now. And so that's why we're focusing this. And it's a very targeted program.
But I'm concerned about the eligibility, kind of waiving the eligibility requirements for certain groups and precedent.
You're on health finance, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, enjoy.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with reference to the relevant section here, Representative Thiessen, can you describe for me the process by which DEED would become aware of the individuals to whom notice is supposed to be provided?
Mr. Chair, anybody that applies for unemployment benefits, and so they typically, and it says here eligible, we may need to change that language on 4.9 to individuals applying to receive unemployment benefits. And if the committee is comfortable with that, I'd actually be happy with doing that. But basically, anybody that applies for unemployment benefits will have lost their job, which is who this is targeted at, and then the application will go on. I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's precisely why I raised the question, because it doesn't say anyone who has applied. It says anyone who is eligible, and I was wondering how they would know who was eligible if they had not applied.
I'd be open to an amendment that would change, delete eligible, and insert individuals who have applied.
Let me ask legal counsel the best way to word that. And they're feverishly turning pages over here. So if we can give it a minute, and I will take the prerogative of the chair to warn you, the computer system, although getting good accolades, still has some bugs in it, so you may have to watch this program over the next few months, Representative Thiessen, to make sure that it's performing to the way that you would like.
Okay.
Legal counsel got correct wording we should probably put in?
Chair and members, I would suggest that on page 4, line 9, strike eligible PCs and insert who make application for.
Chair, I would make that motion.
Members of the committee and Representative Hilty moves the, I don't know what, the verbal amendment on line 4.9, delete eligible to receive and insert who make application for. Does everyone understand? Are there any other questions? All those in, Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps this would be a question for Ms. Novak. I just want to make sure that I have this. Oh, sorry, Ms. Newman. I was looking down when you were talking. So I just want to be clear then of the language. So if we make this change, the language would say that anybody who applied, would there be any review process to make sure that everything was on the up and up, or would it just be anybody who applied would be available for this, whether they qualified or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, this just says that anybody who applies would receive notice from the department that this set of health care benefits may be available to them. It wouldn't be an automatic connection. It would
just
be that the notice would be provided.
And to that point,
Mr. Chair, then that person actually has to apply to DHS to qualify. So the actual eligibility, like the question you're going to, would be somewhere else. This would just be to get the notice out.
Thank you. And I appreciate that. I just haven't had time to review the bill, and the vote was just happening a little bit before I even had a chance to finish the paragraph. So thank you.
Just fine. Are there any other questions? All those in favor of the verbal amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. You have the amendment. You're killing another tree, sir.
Yeah.
Any other questions on this bill? Any other questions? Is there anyone that wanted to testify for or against the bill in the audience? Seeing none, all those in favor of House File 42, I'll renew my motion of House File 42 to be recommended to pass and return to the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division as amended. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
You're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, member.
Same sign, isn't it?
I know.
Sounds great.
I know.
I think next bill, as I get rid of paperwork here, is House File 1116, Representative Dabney.
Good morning, Chair.
You know, prior to doing that, I know Representative Slocum has been looking at the minutes, and we'd like to move the said minutes.
I thoroughly studied the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I move that we approve them.
Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes as written, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Aye. The minutes have passed. Okay, now I'm getting to the Dabney bill. Oh, more trees. Representative Poppy, I'm sure you'd like to move Representative Dabney's bill.
I would like to do that. I'd move House File 1116.
You recommend that you return to the Higher Ed and Workforce Policy?
Higher Ed, Workforce, and Policy
and
finance.
And in order to get it into the, I'm sure in a minute you'll move the A2 amendment.
I would be happy to move the H1116A2 amendment.
If you could get it into the shape that the author would like.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. The A2 amendment, President Obama's budget allows for the capturing of tax returns to satisfy overpayment of unemployment insurance benefits. This simply conforms state law to the same approach.
Okay. Are there any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Bills in the shape that you would like.
Well, it's just short of that, actually, Mr. Chair. I've got a short oral amendment, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, what would your amendment do?
It would, in three separate places, strike the word available. And those are on page 29, line 6.
29.
Page 51, line 4. And page 55, line 30. Oh, and let's add in, if we could, Mr. Chair, page 55, line 21 as well. And this is at the request of legal aid and with the agreement of the department.
And I'm sorry, I was trying to check something here. What was your last statement, Representative?
My last statement was that this amendment is at the request of legal aid and with the agreement of the department.
And that's all the places that you have the preponderance of available evidence that you found?
That's correct. And deleting available actually holds the department to a higher standard of evidence.
Members, hopefully someone's gone through the bill to make sure they got all those particular available. So, Representative Hoppe, would you like to move that amendment?
I would move that amendment.
Are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment by Poppy signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Is it now in the fashion that you would like, Representative Dabney?
It is now, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. You know, there is a thing about carrying department bills when you you kill a lot of trees with them.
Well, hopefully the oral amendment saved one small stick or two.
There you go. Would you care to speak to your bill?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Poppy, for your assistance this morning. House File 1116 is a policy and housekeeping bill brought forward by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. The bill is in four articles. Article 1 is deed policy and includes several small policy issues. Article 2 is deed housekeeping. Mr. Hamilton from the department is here to describe those sections. Articles 3 and 4 are a product of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Group, which is a council made up of legislators, business, labor groups, including the State Chamber of Commerce, NFIB, Mechanical Contractors Association, AFL-CIO, Teamsters Legal Aid, and the Temporary Staffing Association. There's minor policy and housekeeping changes in those sections, and Mr. Nelson from the department is here to describe those. At this point, if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to hand the microphone over to Mr. Hamilton to describe the first two sections of the bill.
Mr. Hamilton, please identify yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Chuck Hamilton. I'm the Director of State Services for the Blind and a member of DEED's legislative team, and it's in that latter capacity I come forward today. As Representative Dabney indicated, there are a few policy provisions in Section 1. Article 1 of the bill, Sections 1 and 2 are related to biobusiness infrastructure. I would note for the committee that this is actually the subject of a separate bill, which is currently going through the process. Sections 3 and 4 relate to the Minnesota Investment Fund. It expands the use of funds already available for the purposes of low-interest loans, renewable energy, training grants to support renewable energy workforce, as well as some money towards or allowing money to be spent for external marketing to enhance those types of activities. Section 5 of Article 1 does relate to state services for the blind, particularly its blind vendor program, a program we've operated since 1938. This is the subject that was before the Commerce and Labor Committee. It has to do with clarifying the, frankly, we have other statute rules and contracts related to this program with our blind vendors. We've been advised to make it clear that in the areas of workers' compensation that the state is not liable for a blind vendor's employee. This section, in addition to going through the Commerce and Labor Committee, has been discussed with labor and industry as well as the chamber and other labor representatives.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you. Just to the test bar, has it also been discussed with the blind vendor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, they have an elected committee of blind vendors. They are well aware of this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, do they support the change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, yes. Thank you. The last policy section from D is Section 6 on page 4. This is from our vocational rehabilitation program. This basically streamlines a process where local entities request dollars for extended employment, and it, the meat of it is requiring audited financial statements of the prior fiscal year, and everyone's on board with that. Mr. Chairman, we go to Article 2. I could go through each section, but I guess I would start by just trying to summarize what these are. A number of changes are changing the phrase Job Training Partnership Act to Workforce Investment Act. These were things that happened in 1998. Commissioner McElroy asked the department last fall to go through our statutes, whether they're the ones that are under the department's wings or they're ones that are in other departments. We've done that. There's a scattering. A lot of them have to do with this WIA, Job Training Partnership, both in our statutes, elsewhere. We also have a number of name changes from economic security or economic development to DEED. Some of them actually, ones I would highlight, are related to some consolidations. These were worked on very closely with the revisor's office. They got very, very technical and complex. The department over 20 plus years is a conglomeration of activities where things have continued to be bolted on, where there's duties in multiple sections, some issues related to fiscal in multiple sections. Working with revisor, we're trying to put them in one place. So a lot of those particular changes result in repealers at the end also, because we're putting it in one place. Those actually are the big pieces that go into this. Mr. Chair, if there were questions or other specific items you'd like me to go through in that section, I'd be happy to do so.
Other questions by the committee? I'm on page 9. And it's a substantial amount of new language.
Mr. Chair, thank you for raising that. That is one of the areas I was trying to highlight in terms of the consolidation. There is a lot of what appears to be new language that is actually existing statute, and we're repealing it elsewhere. In putting this whole thing together in one place, we had to add something somewhere and decrease it elsewhere. And we're confident that we have not either increased anything nor decreased anything.
Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions?
It looks to me like, again, as you've been testifying, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, that this is mostly technical cleanup stuff. There isn't anything else substantive we're not hearing about right now, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gottwald, not to my knowledge.
There seems no questions on these sections, Article 1 and 2. Representative Dabney, do you have an Article 3 you'd like to get to?
Mr. Chair, unemployment. Mr. Nelson can walk us through that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program in Minnesota. I don't know how much detail the committee wishes to go through on Article 3 and Article 4, but I would just like to highlight a couple of articles, I think, which are a couple of sections, I think, which have what I might call a little more significant impact. Most are very, very minor, but they are policy changes. I'd like to highlight Section 11 on page 31. This section requires employers who wish to file appeals on contested unemployment insurance issues to do so online if the appeal is being filed by a third-party agent, meaning an attorney, an accountant, or one of the large service companies. Employers currently will file over 10,000 appeals this year, most done now by fax or by letter. It takes over two people simply to process the appeal. If they do it online, then it's simply all automatic. They can even pick the appeal day, the hearing date, and notice is automatically sent, meaning there's no data entry by the department if we could get employers to do this. And this would simply say if you're using an agent, a third-party agent, that's how it has to be done. If an employer is filing an appeal directly, they can still file it by mail, they can still do it by fax. But if you're pinging someone to do it, that agent should file it online. We believe we can save two positions, literally in staff positions and processing, and put them to more value-added work. The next thing I would like to highlight is Section 13.
Mr. Chair.
This imposes...
Mr. Nelson, if you could just a moment. You had a question to this point?
Well, before we get off of that section, I just wanted to... any concerns from employers about that particular item?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. This was fully endorsed by the State Chamber of Commerce and by the NFIB, who believe it's a good idea to save staff positions on processing and put them to more value-added work. I'd like to highlight Section 13 on page 32. This is a new penalty on employers who fail to provide information requested, a weekly breakdown of wage information. This information is necessary to detect fraud. Currently, if somebody's collecting unemployment benefits returns to work, we don't have a way of matching up exactly how much they earned in any given week unless an employer provides that information upon request. We send 60,000 of these notice requests out per year. Over 20,000 are not returned. And we need them returned to be able to detect fraud. And the thought is we put a $100 penalty. Representative Gunther was adamant and agreed, put in there very clearly that we must state clearly on the notice that a penalty will be assessed if you fail to return the information. Employer groups fully support this. It's about the only way you can detect fraud, absent literally going out to the employer's business and auditing them to try to find out exactly what wages were paid to a particular employee in a given week.
Mr. Nelson, when you're done with this particular comment on the on this piece, I've got a couple of questions. So whenever you're done with...
Mr. Chairman, I would like to just highlight two pieces.
Before you go any farther, Representative Norton, did you... I've got a couple of questions. I want to make sure you go back to page 25, and then again, I want you to explain something on page 27, if you've got a moment.
Mr. Chair, my question was on page 32, so I don't know how you want to process those.
Yes.
Okay. My question was on page 32, and Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, I understand what you're doing here, but if a third of these people are already not responding, how much hope do you have that they will respond to the $100 fine? And do you then, if you if it says on there, you're going to be fined $100, and you have to then send a bill out for the $100, and they don't pay the $100, are you going to be spending more time trying to collect this $100 than it might be worth? So I guess I'm just concerned about it. And then also, if you could explain that it's going into the trust fund and what that means, that would be beneficial to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norton, first of all, we don't have to necessarily send out a bill because it can be done online, meaning when an employer comes in again, they can see penalties which have previously been assessed. And with all online, we don't have to send out specific new notices. They can contest that later when they see it. Of course, as to the penalties that the department assesses, we waive over half the penalties assessed under the statute. We're not in the penalty business. We're in the compliance business. We're trying to get compliance from employers. They contact us and say, here's why I didn't comply. So we're very generous, if you will, on waiving and canceling the penalties. We want compliance. And I say business groups supported this because they'll be the first to admit the only way you can get employers to comply, they don't have any. Again, what happens, the people are laid off from a particular employer, collect unemployment, and then return to work for a different employer. That employer is not going to be affected by the cost. They have no reason to provide the information, especially the companies like ADP, which we send these notices to. That takes their time, their money. They don't care. They just basically throw these notices away. And how do you get them to comply? We ask them to comply. We talk to them. But you know, the only way you can get this information, absent going on an on-site audit, is to say, provided that we're going to assess the penalty. And again, we can do that automatically through the system. So when they come in to pay their taxes in the next quarter, they'll literally see those penalties. We don't have to send out specific bills for them and try to collect on those bills. It's right online. And if you don't pay that bill, you're simply delinquent in what those amounts do. And goes into the trust fund because there was a concern expressed by business groups that, oh, if it went into administrative funds or something else, you'd be just in the penalty business trying to run up money for your own purposes. No, we're not in the penalty business, but if penalties are assessed, they go into the trust fund, which supports benefits and actually ultimately lowers taxes if the trust fund has a sufficient balance in it. So it goes right back to employers, if you will. These penalties.
Mr. Nelson, I've got a couple of questions. Back on page 25, line 18, where it talks about the commissioner may cancel at any time any interest, penalties, or fees from an employer or any portions due. And farther down, it does not apply to unemployment insurance taxes or reimbursements due. Under what circumstances or what would be the fines that the commissioner is getting rid of? And I'm comfortable now that I see the language on the last line of that, but what's the commissioner get to do?
Mr. Chairman, this was brought forward by the legislative auditor because of the conflicts, if you will, between 268.066 and 268.067. You have to actually read those in conjunction. And again, we cancel fees and penalties all the time. That's standard practice. Some things are called penalties, some are called fees. We're in the compliance business. You're assessed various fees if you don't file things on time. We waive over, cancel, if you will, 50% of those, over 50% of all penalties and fees we cancel. As to taxes due, that is only, again, that's in 268.067, and that's only a compromise. I can tell you, under current law, an attorney has to sign off on a compromise. We're asking that be removed because that's simply unnecessary. But I sign them all the time, who are basically done by our senior auditors. And what this is you can have substantial disputes in taxes that are due, disputes on whether somebody was an employee or not, going backwards, whether something was wages, whether it was covered employment. And again, we feel it's in the best interest of the state to get something. Many of these companies are in distress. We get their financial reports before we compromise. They're in distress. The IRS is after the company and everyone else. We want to get as much as we can, but then we have to be willing to compromise to get what we can. We've got liens against many of these companies, and again, we're just trying to get as much as we can.
Mr. Nelson, what you're telling me is that fines, penalties, and liens against the company can be waived by the commissioner, but not unemployment taxes or the fees that they're supposed to pay on my employment when I'm working. Correct?
Mr. Chairman, not exactly. I suppose whether you call it a cancellation or a compromise, the net effect is the same. You can cancel all fees and penalties. And again, this is just more drafted for purposes of the legislative auditor who saw a conflict between the two sections. This just clarifies what's subject to cancellation and then what is subject to compromise.
Okay.
The commissioner currently can compromise anything. Any fees, penalties, and compromise to zero. I mean, this doesn't change the law.
Mr. Nelson, I think I've gotten what we're trying to get to. We can talk a little later when I ask for the list of an example of what the commissioner has done late in the past. I will move along, but I'm just waiting for the next committee where Chairman Ruth Gavina is going to talk about the on page 27, line 16, the annuity payments and lump sums. So I'll stay tuned for that one. I'm not sure exactly where you were, but Representative Overmuller, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, to that same point, with respect to the department's ability to compromise with employers, the law doesn't allow you to do the same compromise with an employee who has been overpaid. Can you explain why that is and why we should be making a distinction? I'm sure you're more familiar with this than me, but
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the department isn't asking for any change here. The only change which is occurring on page 25 is actually lines 32, 33, and 34, which is an attorney signing off. That's the only change. Otherwise, it's just a language change. It doesn't change the effect. It's a practical matter. The commissioner has the authority on a benefit overpayment to do it. You have to ask. And what a statute provides is discretion. Commissioner has discretion regarding the recovery of any overpayment. That's what current law provides. And the recovery can be to zero. If you look on, look up my statute, the commissioner actually has that authority currently. We can simply say, okay, we won't recover the overpayment. It still exists, but we will take no means to collect it. In fact, we'll never collect it, except unless somebody voluntarily pays it. But so we have that authority currently.
I wish I'd known that 25 years ago.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up on that, please. And I assume you're referring to 268.18, and you don't have the statute in front of you, but I do. So I was questioning regarding that's a discretion as to whether to go after someone to do the recovery piece of it, in order to send it the revenue for collection and so forth. But there's no provision for actually coming to an agreement with a distressed employee who has also got financial distress, and saying, you know, we'll take, you know, 30 cents on the dollar to clear this matter up. And I'm just wondering if you believe that's within your discretion already, or if there is some changes that need to be done in that regard.
Mr. Nell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Overman, that is that's a substantial change about the actual cancellation. That's been discussed in our advisory council. I mean, it's been considered. But we believe currently we have the authority to, in effect, if you want to call it, bury it. In fact, it doesn't exist. Nobody would see it. It wouldn't be reported anywhere. It doesn't go on a credit rating. In fact, then immediately after 6 years, it expires. So it has the same effect of doing exactly what you're suggesting. So I would believe it as a practical matter exists.
Mr. Nelson, please continue. I think I'm not sure exactly where you were. Did you had you finished up?
I would simply like to highlight two small sections within Article 4. I'd like to highlight on page section 12 on page 37 and 38. The United States Department of Labor held this out of conformity with federal law. And under the commissioner's authority under 268.23, it was severed from the law. So it has not been enforced in effect for the past about a year and a half. So we're simply asking it to be removed from the statute because it no longer exists as enforceable law by the ruling of the Secretary of Labor. The other thing I would like to highlight within Section 4 is Section 28 on page 49. This looks like new language. But what happened when we submitted this, when I submitted it to the reviser, I did a strikeout and underline, but there were so many strikeouts and so many underlines in 268.086 that the reviser said repeal it and reprint it. We simply got rid of some obsolete provisions dealing with filing continued requests, which hadn't been done in about 15 years. So this simply updates the law to current practices and doesn't change how the current continued request process is done. But it looks like it's all new. That's simply because of how the reviser decided to put it within the bill. But it does not change how it practice has occurred for the last probably 6 or 7 years.
And well, thank you. I'm kind of wondering about, Representative Dabney, if you just quickly, if you quickly go over the, you know, when you, the earlier amendment striking the word available.
Yeah.
The notice must explain that this matter will be decided on based on the preponderance of evidence. what are you doing there? And
Mr. Sheriff, I could, since that was a proposal from Legal Aid, if the representative from Legal Aid could come forward and speak to that.
Could you get Mr. Elwood again?
No, actually. his much more attractive colleague. Or Mr. Nelson.
Or Mr. Elwood. briefly, if you could explain what you're doing there, we would appreciate it, and because we've got a couple other bills.
Mr. Chairman, what happened and why the word available? We originally worked with Legal Aid on drafting, and I originally presented to them preponderance of evidence, and that's what they agreed to. When my colleague, now Craig Gustafson, used to work upstairs in the reviser's office, redrafted it internally, he put the word available in it. And so it wasn't the exact language agreed to. It also, the word available doesn't conform to the definition which is set out on page 35. And so you might have an argument that we wanted to, preponderance of evidence is defined, but preponderance of available evidence is not defined. So you want it to all match up, otherwise is there some argument that, wait a minute, available evidence is different than the definition. And so we're simply making consistent with the definition we're asking to put in the statute, plus making consistent with our prior agreement so that there's no concern that someone's trying to pull a fast one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not to your point, but it's to I guess relevant to the bill. Mr. Nelson and I have had a discussion about it and talking about the question of how beneficiaries receive the payment for the money under the unemployment insurance system. And right now the two primary ways are through direct deposit into a checking account or a debit card provided by the department. And there was an RFP done to
to provide the debit cards, and some beneficiaries have raised concerns about the fees that they pay for using those debit cards. That's better in many ways than other alternatives like check cashing services. I'm wondering if what Mr. Nelson or Representative Dabney would think of an amendment to the bill to just require that the department provide paper checks if requested by a beneficiary, and to provide and make sure that in their materials on benefits they let beneficiaries know that they can receive a paper check if they choose to, rather than a debit card or direct deposit. And it just so happens they might have an amendment drafted if that's acceptable.
Representative Dabney, so Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, the department would have to strongly oppose that amendment. That would substantially increase the cost for the unemployment insurance program. We're going to send out over 3 million payments this year in the next 12 months in unemployment insurance payments. If people in numbers at all were requesting that, the cost could go significant. And that just simply means we only get a set amount to administer the program. We have to pay the mailing costs, meaning the postage. Any piece of correspondence we send out, as I last heard, estimate is about 75 cents per document that we send. So if we were to send that out in any large numbers at all, you could be looking at an increased cost to the unemployment insurance program of millions, which simply means you don't do something else. And we don't have the check printing capacity. Even the capacity, you'd have to change the whole application, not the whole application process, but you'd have to computerize that, which is expensive. We've met with Representative Winkler, the commissioner, and I, and talked about this. The commissioner had even suggested, and the commissioner's intent was to have a separate mailing sent to people, which the department would pay for, which would say, here's how you can easily avoid fees if you have a debit card. They can walk into any Visa bank, which is 90% of all banks in Minnesota, and go up to a teller and draw out the money. No cost, no fee.
Mr. Nelson, are you saying that I can't get a check now from the Department of Unemployment Insurance? I mean, if I was on unemployment as a construction worker, I cannot come down to an office and say, I want the check in my hand? I thought I could. So,
to represent it, we would run it through the same as we could issue a check to a vendor or something else. I suppose in pure theory, we could do it. But in practice, no.
Okay, Mr. Nelson, before he goes much farther, you and the commissioner were in my office talking about this particular issue, and one of my concerns with any kind of electronic transfer is that you can go back into that electronic transfer up to 90 days or 120 days or even longer and pull that money out. Did you check into that at all?
Mr. Chairman, not yet. I will check into that. But that's on a direct deposit. Currently, 70% of all people who receive an unemployment insurance payment do so by direct deposit into their bank account. 30% receive through a debit card, which is provided at no cost and no cost to the department by U.S. banks. A person can gain access to that with no fees by going to any U.S. bank ATM, no fees. They can access it by going into any bank that takes Visa, which is 90% of all banks in Minnesota, and going to the teller and draw it out. We believe that it's better than a paper check, because if you don't have a bank account, where do you cash a paper check, which could be for thousands of dollars? And we believe it's safer. We don't have the issue anymore of lost or stolen checks, which we had over one person spent their whole day on lost and stolen checks, saving like that cost. It saves the department hundreds and hundreds, I'd say millions of dollars to use the debit card, because we don't have to pay the cost of mailing. To do so, to require us to provide this, is going to cost millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Representative Winkler, did you have another question?
Well, yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess my comment would be that if it's an option, it's not that people can choose. But some people don't like direct deposit because they don't like the feeling that their money is being moved electronically. There are privacy concerns. I've heard people talk about that. I don't share that particular concern, but I know that there are people who do. We have, of course, there is a cost to providing debit cards. And as far as I can tell, U.S. Bank is in the money-making business, as they should be, so they're not doing this as a free service. Somebody's paying somewhere. Actually, most of the money comes from the merchants who process the debit cards every time you go to a gas station or grocery store. And there are other ways that the U.S. Bank makes money, including any potential float on the interest that they're when they're holding money and on the ATM fees. So there are a lot of ways they are making money on this. And if the debit card is such a good deal, which it may or may not be, it's better than the Department of Defense. It's better than I think just about every other state in their debit card system. But if it's such a great thing, then I wouldn't think you'd have too many people who would request a paper check. I just think that I don't know what the challenge would be in offering it as a choice, making sure people know that they can choose a check, which certainly used to be how it was done. But, respected Representative Dabney, we don't have to throw out an amendment and have a vote on it. But I think the information I have is that moving to a complete debit card system saved the state $3 million. That's 30% of all the people getting money. So if you had a small number who were getting checks, that's not going to cost millions because you only save $3 million by moving the whole 30% of the system in that direction.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Winkler. I do share some of the concerns, and when I was first appointed to the UI Advisory Council, spent quite a bit of time exploring the issue of debit cards and fees and the like with Mr. Nelson. The concerns that before I start on the concerns, I think increasingly at least larger employers are going to a direct deposit function. I know the school district I worked for, by the end, you couldn't get a paper check, even if you asked for one. My wife's employer, public sector employer, they don't even get a receipt of their paycheck when it's deposited. You have to go online to download your own receipt. So increasingly employers are going in the same direction the department is going. I would be concerned if we added an amendment at this time or going forward that we're adding or increasing the fiscal note on the bill. And this is unfortunately not the environment to be adding to expenses.
Well, Representative Winkler, could you explore that with Representative Dabney in the next, between now and workforce finance? And because we've got two other bills and one other question. So I support your idea there. I was under the impression I could get a paper check if I could ever get unemployment.
Mr. Chair, I hope to explore that with Representative Dabney. And while many employers may be saying you can't get a paper check, I know that the big payroll companies that do a lot of the small business payroll definitely provide that option because a lot of people just don't like it. And because it's the exception to the rule now, I think the cost would be fairly minimal to provide it.
Representative Hilty?
Oh, pass, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Obermiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple, I'm sorry. But and maybe we can talk, some of these answers maybe can come offline, but regarding the burden of proof that's being, there's a reference on line 55.26 that's striking the words without regard to any burden of proof. Perhaps Representative Dabney or Mr. Nelson could address that. The preponderance of the evidence is going to tell us whether we're getting someone up over the hump of a win or a loss, but the burden of proof refers to what happens in the event of a tie, and I'm trying to find out what the intention of striking that word, those words are.
Mr. Chairman, what's page are you referring to?
Right, page 55, line 26 and 27. It may be something that's moved in the bill, and I didn't find it, but that's the striking of without regard to any burden of proof.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is no current burden of proof in the unemployment insurance law. There is a, if you want to call it a fairly technical, a fairly natural burden of proof If an individual quits their job, they are ineligible for benefits unless a preponderance of evidence shows they fall under one of the nine exceptions. In almost all instances, that's going to come from an applicant. An applicant quits would present evidence that they fall under one of the exceptions. If an individual, on the other hand, is discharged, the law currently provides and has for 70 years, said you are not denied unless a preponderance of the evidence shows that you committed misconduct. And in almost all instances, that's going to come from an employer. An applicant could hold themselves ineligible by essentially confessing to it. But the presumption, if you're discharged, if you will, in the law, is you're eligible. You are eligible unless the evidence shows that you're ineligible. If there isn't evidence showing you're ineligible, you're eligible. So there's almost a natural, what I would call, burden, if you will, within the statute. But there's no burden placed on a particular party. And the reason for that is because unemployment benefits are a request for state funds from the state, not from an employer or employer fund. An employer may or may not be in business anymore. The employer may or may not care. The employer may or may not be affected by the separation from employment. So what you're really saying is an applicant is asking for money from the state, for state funds.
Mr. Nelson.
And we're under an obligation to determine the entitlement without regard to what an employer wishes to do.
Mr. Almiro, do you have another question?
Well, I have several questions about this area, but since we're moving it out of here, I'm happy to talk to Mr. Nelson offline and ask questions about those.
Any other questions on this particular bill? Any other questions? Seeing none. Poppy renews her motion for House File 1116 to be recommended to pass as amended and returned to the Higher Ed and Workforce Policy and Finance Division, where more questions will be forthcoming. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no. Mr. Dabney, you're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I think let's get Representative Sertich up.
Mr. Chair, I move that House File 925 be recommended to pass and return to the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division.
Representative Sertich, good to have you here.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
This isn't your first visit, is it?
No, and actually I'm a former member of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, so that was interesting for me to hear. It gave me a little flashback to the early part of this decade when I used to carry that bill. Members, I have before you a bill dealing with unemployment as well, but looking at the definition of how we factor unemployment. And within your handouts, you have an article from the Wall Street Journal from earlier this week. Members, unemployment rate is a key indicator of our labor market performance. An unemployed person, as defined, is without work, available to work, or actively searching for work. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, in a current population survey of the federal government, does monthly surveys, and there are actually six ways you can clarify who is unemployed in the unemployment rate. It's U1 through U6. Currently, what we use is the U3, which is somewhere in the middle. There is a broader definition, the U6, of counting unemployment. And currently, right now, the Department of Economic Development, all that we ask of them within our laws to provide current state and sub-state labor market information and forecasts in cooperation with other agencies. With this bill being passed, we would be able to look at the broadest measure of unemployment, the U6. And by doing so, we'd be able to, I think, get a better sense of who is unemployed in Minnesota and why they're unemployed in Minnesota. This would take into account all unemployed Minnesotans, plus those that are employed but are working for fewer hours than they would like, and also those discouraged who have looked recently for work or expressed interest in working. And also within this survey that the federal department does, we can find out what the barriers are for being unemployed, whether it be transportation or child care or the like. And members having served on this committee in the past, I think it'd be important for us and be a helpful tool to move and collect this data in a more broad way, because I think we do a better job of serving both businesses and individuals, unemployed or underemployed individuals, by knowing what their particular barriers are to employment. This data is already collected. This would just make sure that our own deed agency can manipulate, in the best sense of the word, manipulate that data and give us a better picture of why Minnesotans are underemployed or unemployed. And members, I've worked with Deed a bit on this issue and have experts here to help me if you ask me any difficult questions.
Members, do you, Representative Hilke, do you have a difficult question?
Perhaps not, Mr. Chair. Representative Sertich, how is the data collected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilke, monthly, I believe, and you can nod maybe and I can get this one. I think it's a telephone survey, or is it a paper survey as well? Yep, the follow-up is via telephone survey of unemployed or underemployed Minnesotans collected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, is that according to some sampling principles, or how expensive is that?
Now, Mr. Chair, Representative, you've exhausted my knowledge on this. I'd like Mr. Hines come down from Deed to help out on this.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Hine. I'm the research director at Deed. I head up the Labor Market Information Office, which is responsible for the standard unemployment statistics, among other things that we now produce. In response to your question, Mr. Representative, the survey is a stratified sample. It's the basis for a lot of statistics, including the national unemployment data. And the follow-up is via a telephone after an initial visit. Can I ask you to expand on your question or clarify?
Mr. Heim, what I was asking is, according to what sampling principles is the survey done? You're obviously not calling every resident of the state of Minnesota.
No, Representative, the sample for the state's about 800 households right now, which is too small to be able to provide direct estimates of these labor market characteristics. That's why it currently requires econometric modeling to produce the U3 measure that we currently produce. But the sample is relatively small within the state.
Members, we have one other bill after this, so I'm going to give this to 11:45, and then we're going to vote on it. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does this bring down our ERA? You know, I guess the question I have is, does this make Minnesota look better or worse compared to other states and comparative statistics? Because I'm concerned. My concern would just be some state officials like to travel a lot and talk about how terrible Minnesota's business climate is, and I would hate to have official unemployment numbers that would seem to substantiate that if it's somehow used differently than how other states do it.
Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, I believe that's a good question, and an issue I've discussed with actually Commissioner McElroy, who you may want to discuss this further with as well if you'd like. Certainly the number would double almost in every instance as far as U3 versus U6, but this does not preclude the state to give the standard U3 information, which every other state gives, to keep that the same, but we would just have more data on why. And actually, in a tighter labor market, it could be argued that this data would be more helpful for seeing who is unemployed, why, or underemployed, and it could help attract business to the state as well.
So, Mr. Chair, the goal then is just to provide better information for policy making and decision making at the state level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that is correct.
Thank you.
You could almost develop a plan from that. Representative McDotwad.
Sounds like Representative Pepin wants to ask a question on this point. No.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. The language on 1.9 and 1.10 says that it's the estimates of total official unemployment, and you just said that we could still provide the U3 numbers. If this were a total measure, then is that, I guess I'm confused as to why that would be possible. If this is our official number, why could we give a different number to the federal government?
Representative Fertig. Representative Mahoney and Representative Pepin, right now, within the current law, all we say is provide current state and sub-state labor market information and forecasts. So already give them broad scope in doing so. They will still continue to collect the U3 information as it's a more narrow definition. So it's not like they'd only do one or the other. They'd have both of those data and information available. And right now, the Bureau of Labor Statistics collects all this information already. This would just make sure that, and Mr. Hein would have to get this economic model in place because the sample size is so small. So this is really directing the agency to set up this new structure and model so that we can provide this information to the state in a more month-by-month or time fashion.
Did you have a question, Representative McGottwell?
Yes, Mr. Chair, actually a few of them. Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, as I work at this, I don't see any problem with us having more information, especially if we can confirm the veracity of it and make sure that it's accurate. I think it would be useful to have this information. I had some of the same concerns Representative Pepin asked. One of the questions I have is concerning, is this, and it goes to what Representative Hilty was asking, is this actually an expansion? If we're only doing 800 phone calls now, do we need to do 1,000 to get more of this information? In other words, is this going to require an expansion of our surveying to get good, accurate information under these broader indices?
Representative Sertich or Mr. Hein?
Chairman, Representative. The survey itself is conducted by the Census Bureau on behalf of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's done under federal appropriations and statutes at the federal level. We would have no control or ability to augment that sample. We do get the results of the survey, and the intention here is to use those results in a productive manner.
So,
Mr. Chair and Representative Sertich, this really is stuff we're already gathering. It's being gathered by someone. We're not adding to that workload. We're just getting the data.
Well, to that point, there would be some more work on the front end to set up a model to collect and manipulate this data so that it can be helpful and useful. Just as the sample size is too small, and Mr. Hein and others had to work on making sure we had the right model in place to use this information, a similar process would have to happen to make sure we could utilize the U6 information as well.
Yes, quickly, Mr. Chair. Representative Sertich, any chance this is expanding unemployment eligibility? Does it's not changing eligibility requirements, correct?
Mr. Chair, if I've got well noticed.
Great. And one more question, if I may, Mr. Chair. Is the term sub-state defined in statute? What does it refer to?
Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, coming from Greater Minnesota, and somehow I'd like to call it Greatest Minnesota, maybe we can work that in the statute, but sub-state is, I think, defined as regional sectors of regional areas of the state.
Mr. Chair, I'll look forward to working with Representative Sertich to change that wording.
Wow.
Thank you.
You know, the things we find out in workforce policy. Seeing no other questions. Actually, she's too late. We're going to vote.
It's important stuff.
Now, I know it's important stuff, but, you know, your partner there. Yeah. All those in favor of, I'll renew the motion. So, Representative O'Mueller renews his motion.
I renew my motion.
To pass and return to the Higher Ed Workforce Development Policy Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Nope.
You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
Committee. Mr. Sertich.
Thank you.
Representative Briner.
Thank you.
Representative, I know you've got a witness up from Mankato. Even though I made the drive, and it is a lovely drive last Friday, we will give you as much time as we possibly can, even if it goes a few minutes over. But.
Mr. Chair, we'll be pretty quick, and I'll just say I think it's still early enough to say top of the morning to you. So.
Well, thank you. Would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1048 to pass and be re-referred to Higher Education and Workforce Development Finance. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Chair and members, House File 1048 extends unemployment benefits to workers with reduced hours who participate in targeted training through the WIRED Federal Grant Program. This extension is offered as a variation of the shared work plan in Minnesota Statute Section 268-135. There are three aspects to this bill. The first is the experience of a high technology business in the current economic downturn. We have with us today Mr. Dennis Seamer from Mankato, who is the CEO of VTech Incorporated, which designs and manufactures component processing equipment. Mr. Seamer will speak to his company's experience.
Thank you, ma'am. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today. My name is Dennis Seamer. I'm CEO of VTech Incorporated in Mankato, Minnesota. We manufacture electronic component handling and packaging equipment. We sell this worldwide. We have sales in 34 different countries. I have a high-tech workforce to develop and maintain and sell this product. And the economy has severely limited our sales, as it has for many other companies in our industry and throughout the world. And as a result, two things have happened. One is that we got a fair amount of time on our hands. We got a workforce that isn't completely engaged, and we also see severely restricted cash flow. Now, there's two things about this. One is that this is an ideal time for us to provide additional training for our people so that they can upgrade their skills and become even more qualified to build and develop new products. The other thing is, of course, that money is pretty tight to be doing this with. The idea is that we could somehow, put them on a shared work program, and during that period of time that they're on the shared work period, they could be going to school and learning new technology. That would allow them to have the remaining time. They would remain on our payroll, and they could be developing new products, so as the economy turns around, we would be able to hit the ground running with new products in the marketplace at the right time with the right product. The WIRED grant has been put together so that the schooling, the educational opportunity is there. That's being developed currently by South Central College. And there are seven different companies involved in this. It's not just VTech Incorporated. There are several other allied companies down there that are involved in this. Now it's a matter of making this available on a shared work basis, and if the law could be amended somewhat so that this could be accomplished. The benefits of this, as I already stated, are for the company and for the company would be that we would have new products and we'd have a highly educated workforce. The employees would stay on our payroll. They would remain eligible for all of the health insurance benefits and other benefits that we have. They would be participating in that. They would not be in a position where they would want to leave the company and perhaps leave the area. If we lose this team, if we lose members of these teams, it is incredibly difficult to put them together. This team is not just a matter of finding a mechanical engineer and putting them to work. It's a matter of the legacy. It's the information that they've acquired as a team functioning and developing other products, that they become a team. And this is something that we would lose if we lost any one of those members. So we really, it's very important for a company, a high-tech company, to keep their technology team intact. If we lay them off, of course, they lose income. We can't do that. They lose their benefits. They're out there on the loose, and they're going to be out writing resumes and probably leaving the area because of the economy and the scarcity of jobs. So it's very important for us to try to keep this together. And that's the purpose of the bill, and that's why I and my colleagues in the Mankato area, especially on this pilot program, are very supportive of this.
Before any other questions, I'll ask...
Mr. Chair, could I just finish elaborating the bill before? Because this is just one element of the VTech experience. So, Mr. Chair and members, the second element of the bill is the shared work plan, which currently exists in statute and was created in 1994 to reduce layoffs. And the third is the WIRED program, which is a federal grant designed to build talent in rural Minnesota. Mankato is just one example of a place where the WIRED grant is in place to support renewable energy industry. We have with us potentially today, Lee Nelson is in the audience to answer any questions that relate to the unemployment aspects of the bill. And Teresa Kittrich, which is the executive director of the WIRED program, is also with us. So with that, I'll open it to questions.
Well, I've got a couple. I'll ask this. Mr. Nelson and actually Deed is in support of this particular bill. Is that correct?
Yes, Deed was actually a partner in the bill's creation. It grew out of discussion between Mr. Seamers and the Workforce Center in Mankato, and they approached Deed on this.
And then Representative Bryant, how do they? If you're going, is it? Are you always in a 32-hour week, or is it 24-hour week? How does that particular thing work? I mean, can you go any number of hours, or is there a set deal?
Okay. I think Mr. Nelson will come and help address that with you, if it's okay with the chair here.
Lee is always welcome in the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Lee Nelson. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs for the Unemployment Insurance Program. What this bill does is allow essentially some of the restrictions on the current shared work program to be waived so that we could fit it within the WIRED grant. Currently, individuals could only be paid hourly employees, but Seamer and others have said they'd like to apply to salaried workers. Current law provides that you have to be involving a group of five or more employees. And a concern was that there could be companies and have them approach companies which are smaller than that, have only three workers who want to be involved. So this bill would simply allow the flexibility within the shared work program to fit those companies which want to take advantage of a WIRED grant. I can explain the current shared work program if you would like, Mr. Chairman. You questioned about the 32 hours. What it currently provides is that you have a full-time employee, and the employer submits a plan whereby a group of employees, five or more, hours would be reduced to prevent layoffs. So you would reduce five workers from 40 hours down to 32, thus saving one job. And current law would allow you to reduce it down to 24 hours a week. That's what current law requires. That's simply that restrictions that could be reduced down to, let's say, 3 days a week, preventing multiple layoffs. But an employer under current law has to submit a plan which has to be approved for a fixed period of time. They can't fluctuate one week doing so many hours and the next week so many hours. Once a plan is approved, it is fixed in place for a certain set period of time until the employer, a certain maximum period of time of up to a year, but an employer could ask that it be terminated sooner than that if they chose.
Representative Gutwell, did you have a question? Representative Garrett.
To this point, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, unemployment insurance rating for a company,
How is that impacted if the company takes advantage of this program? Does that impact their insurance rating at all on the UI program?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, yes, it will. All unemployment benefits experience rating, I shouldn't say all of them, most benefits are experience rated, so it would go back into the employer's experience rating and they would pay higher taxes in the future. The shared work is simply an unemployment insurance benefit, and it would go back into the employer's experience rating and they would pay higher taxes in the future to replenish the unemployment insurance trust fund.
Right, thank you.
I have this question. How many, the wired grant area is 38 counties, I believe, in southern Minnesota, and how many companies do you see taking advantage of this? I actually have heard of this as a great idea, sending the employees back to school rather than just laying them off. But I'm just wondering, how many do you envision having taking advantage of this, Representative Burnett?
Mr. Chair, at this point, I don't think we know how many will take advantage of it, but there are 27 wired grants that are active at the moment. So,
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, to your question, currently, estimation is most companies would fit under current law, but this simply allows flexibility for those who can't fit under the current shared work program to do so. But most of the companies will fit under the current law, so that's why it's fairly limited, and there is a sunset on the bill of 2 years out. If Wired is a success, we would be looking to expand it, and of course the department would be seeking a
further. 2 years, you want these companies back up and running full speed, selling everything in the world. Representative Gottwald, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, how are we measuring outcomes? This is geographically constrained, as I understand, too. And then what happens if the dollars run out before June 30th of 2011?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Gottwald, are you asking about the dollars, the unemployment dollars or the wired grant dollars?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brainerd, I'm asking about the grant dollars specifically under the first section of the bill, and then again, the measurement of outcomes in general for both the unemployment, the shared work portion, as well as the grant.
A new person at the table, please identify yourself and answer the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, my name is Teresa Kittredge. I'm the Executive Director of the Wired Grant, the Renewable Energy Marketplace in Minnesota. And to your question on availability of funds for the Wired Grant, we sunset in July of 2010 unless there is a no-cost extension from the federal government. And as far as measurements from the federal side, we have pretty strong measurement requirements from the Federal Department of Labor. We will be doing quarterly reports and working with VEED on the unemployment side. But on our side, we have pretty stringent measurements and outcomes that we will be reporting into the Department of Labor and sharing with the state.
Would you like a copy of that? One more piece of paper we don't need right now.
No more paper.
Are there any other questions? Seeing none, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1048 be passed and referred to the Higher Education Workforce Development Finance Committee.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? I think you're on your way.
Thank you.
Thank you for
Thank
your
you very
testimony.
Much, members.
Members, I don't think we have any unfinished business at the present time. So with that, we stand in adjournment.